4. Count Orlant was overwhelmed by Pierrat's news. She had hoped for comfort from him. Instead, to her surprise, she found that she must and could be the one to offer comfort. She knew, of course, that her father was fond of Itale and had been deeply distressed by what he too called his running off. She knew that he tried to read Novesma Verba and to understand politics, and that it always left him puzzled and depressed. He was unworldly, as Pierrat had learned, or, as he himself put it, he hadn't a head for these things. That had led her to assume that he would not be too much dismayed at her tidings. After all, what did he know about state offenses, trials, accusations, prisons? Less even than she. But his ignorance, instead of protecting him, left him open to the blow.
"In prison? They put him in prison, Guida's son?" he said over and over. "Why, that's absurd! It must be a mistake! What would Itale ever do to make them put him in prison? He's a gentleman, he's a gentleman's son. He's not the sort of fellow they lock up in jails."
Then, as he began to believe her and his imagination grasped the event, his protests ceased. He fell silent, and soon said in a humble voice,
"I think I'll lie down for a while, my dear. I feel a little tired."
She went upstairs with him and built up the fire in his hearth, for he said he felt the chill. He looked old as he lay there on the leather couch, old, patient, quiet. Why must this, too, hurt him? The girl thought with outrage, kneeling at the hearth. Orlant Valtorskar had never wished harm to any creature, and for all good that had come to him, he had been grateful. Now he was old, not well. Pierrat would leave him soon. After his death, his estate would be sold. Everything he knew, everything he had, was slipping away from him. It was as if he had written his name on the wind. Why, then, must he suffer the ills of other men?
"I suppose they'll let the boy have letters from his people, at least," he said, moving his head restlessly.
"Emmanuel thinks the man in Krasnoy is right. They shouldn't do anything at all just at first, not even write. So the people who had him arrested will forget about him."
"You mean they're to behave as if no one cared what became of him? But how will that make him feel?"
"Emmanuel thinks they wouldn't let him see the letters anyway."
"Not let him see letters from his own people? What harm can it do when he's locked in jail? I don't understand it. I don't understand any of it."
"Perhaps they will let him get letters. And of course Emmanuel plans to make an appeal if he has to. But it's really all so unsure now, where he is even."
Count Orlant was silent for a minute.
"I can't believe it," he said. "Do you remember when he came over here to say goodbye in the storm that night? It seems no time at all since then."
It seemed a long time to Pierrat since that night, but she said only gently,
"Don't talk as if he was dead, Papa. He isn't. He'll come back. Laura says so too."
And Count Orlant accepted, at least for the moment, the weighty judgment of Laura and Pierrat. When she left her father, Pierrat put on her coat and went outside into the early dark, the cold and starlight of winter night. She could not stay shut in the warmth indoors. The sky was hard and the stars bright, small, multitudinous. The lake lay black. There was the queer snapping silence of frost, and the air bit throat and lungs as if instead of breathing, one were drinking ice-cold water. Pierrat walked down to the shore and stood there under the pines looking out to the lake and the height of the winter sky. Orion hung there, the belt and sword of stars, the bright dog at heel. Note: Sirius, sometimes called the Dog Star, is the brightest star in the night sky and is part of the Canis Major, Greater Dog, constellation, below the Orion constellation. In mythology, Orion is a hunter, and Canis Major his hound. End note. Pierrat stood still, her bare hands thrust deep into the sleeves of her coat, shivering now and then from head to foot, and in that hour she came into her inheritance. She knew the great hour as it passed. She accepted without reservation what it brought her, the passion of her generation, the end of her childhood. If this was her world, she was strong enough to live in it. She was a woman not trained for any public act, not trained to defiance, brought up to the woman's part, waiting. So she would wait. For any act done consciously may be defiant, may be independent, may change life utterly. But one can act thus only if one knows there is no safety. So she thought, that Epiphany night, looking up at Orion and the other stars. Note, Epiphany night, Christian feast day commemorating the visit of the three wise men to the Christ child when Jesus was revealed to be the Son of God. In the Western Church, it is traditionally celebrated on January 6th. End note. One must wait outside. There is no hiding away from storm, waste, injustice, death. There is no shelter, no stopping, only a pretense, a mean, stupid pretense of being safe and letting time and evil pass by outside. But we are all outside, Pierrot thought, and all defenseless. There is no safe house but death. Nothing of our own building will protect us, not the jails, nor the palaces, nor the comfortable houses. But the grandeur of knowing that, the pride and grandeur of being on one's own at last, alone, under the enormous and indifferent sky, unhoused and unprotected, to be nothing, a girl, confused, grieved, frightened, foolish, shivering in the January frost, all that, yes, but also to learn at last the stature of her spirit, to come into her inheritance. She went back to the house presently and sat alone by the fire in the living room. Her thoughts went on, calmer, less exalted, though sourced in that hour's exaltation as a stream in a rising spring. She did not think now about Itala, yet he, the man in prison, the absent one, was the cause and center of this change. She thought of Laura, of Guida and Eleonora, and of her father, and of Eisnar, of Givon Costa, of herself. I don't belong there, she thought, and presently, what I have to do is here at home. She could not have explained what it was she had to do. She was not carrying on a dialogue, not questioning and answering, but discovering.
I don't want to go back to Eisnar. Papa's getting old, he's not well, he needs me. But I wouldn't stay here if that were all. He wouldn't let me stay here if that were all. He knows you have to send your children away. But I have no reason to go to Eisnar. I would just be safe and comfortable there. That's Givon's life, not mine. He has work to do there. I don't. I'd keep his house. I'd be a good wife. I'd help bring up Batista. I could do it. I could do it perfectly well. I'd be in jail. I'd be in prison for all my life. I can't leave Malafrena. I have to do what I have to do, not other people's work. I have to find my way. I have to wait. To wait.
She thought of Givon Costa, his dark, grave face, the turn of his head. She had not the least sense of disloyalty to him in her thoughts. That would come later, along with self-doubt and shame, when the social human world came back into the balance. At the moment, she was still as far as Orion from all that. She was alone with herself, trying to find out the truth, and nothing was in the balance but truth and lies. She had lied to Givon Costa, promising him what she could not give.
Givon,
she said his name aloud. The house was still. She could hear the cook and the maid talking back in the kitchens, a murmur of voices like a brook far off. If he would wait for her, until she had done here what she had to do. But what had she to do here but wait? There was nothing urgent, No one who could not get on without her. No one needed her to stay. No one wanted her, perhaps, so much as Givon did.
"But it's me he wants," she said.
And now the inward dialogue began, and would go on for a long time. "And who am I? He doesn't know, neither do I. I have to find out by myself, or else I never will. I have to wait, but he won't understand. If he'd come here, I could make him understand, here. I'm not myself in Isnar. I'm always what other people want me to be, there. Here is the only place I will ever understand." Laura would understand her. Laura had understood Itala when she had not. She had never until this night understood why he had left home. Now it was perfectly clear to her. He had felt towards Malafrena as she felt towards Isnar. It was a shelter, not part of the way. They had all known what to expect of him, here, and all they asked of him he could have done easily, too easily. He had had to go off and try to find what it was that he and only he could do, what was necessary to him. So, in Isnar, if she chose, she could avoid ever staking herself. She could do and be all they asked of her, and the reward was sure. It looked now as if Itala had staked himself and lost. Pierrot thought of the stars she had seen flaring over the lake and mountains outside. In daylight, in summer, if you could see the stars, they would be those, the stars of the midwinter. What she had at stake, what she had to give and to lose, she thought, did not amount to much. She had no talents at all, no great intellect, and nothing special to undertake. All she had to do was, like all things women had to do, a matter of daily redoing, an endless reaffirmation, nothing ever finished and complete. It would never be done, and it had to be done. It was her life she wanted, the whole of it, not a reward. Such as it was hers to live, so long as she would take the risk. So long as, having received her inheritance, she would not let it become a prison house. So long as she set freedom first. But it was very difficult. No one had ever spoken to her about what freedom is for a woman, what it might consist of, and how it is to be won, or not won, that seemed the wrong word for a woman's freedom, worked at, perhaps. She heard her father moving about upstairs. He soon came down, and they went in for supper. The overseer Gavre, just returned from Portacheca, joined them. When he had reported his negotiations at the mill to Count Orlant, he asked Pierrot, in his low, husky voice, "I hope it wasn't bad news that took you and Miss Sorde home, Contessina." Pierrot let her father reply, "Aye, it was bad, Gavre. Young Sorde has been put in prison in the east somewhere." Gavre looked taken aback, but said nothing, evidently feeling that he could not, without propriety, ask what a gentleman had done to get put in prison. Count Orlant stared gloomily at his plate. Pierrot spoke up.
"He didn't steal somebody's watch, you know. He's a political prisoner. I suppose the government doesn't like something he printed in his journal, so they put him in jail for 5 years.
Gavre winced.
"I didn't know they'd do that," he said. "We're a bit beside the way of all that up here. It seems very hard."
And he added, surprising Pierrot,
"This is hard for Miss Laura. She thinks the world of her brother, I guess."
"She'll think the higher of him for this."
"She'll need to."
She caught what he meant at once. The talk, the gossip around the lake, the speculation and commiseration, the gloating on disaster.
"They don't know what it means,"
she said haughtily.
"I don't know what it means but shame and waste and pain for the lad and his people," her father said.
"Itala did what he believed he ought to do, what he had to do. He's freer than the men who put him in jail. He's freer than any of us. Even if he died there, it wouldn't be wasteful. It wouldn't be shameful."
"You may be right, daughter. I don't know much about these things, neither do you. It seems a waste to me when a man of 25 is thrown away like that, locked up to do nothing. And how can Guida help but feel shame when they say to him, "Where's your son?" And how is it for Eleonora, who can do nothing for him, maybe not even write to him? All I can see in it is grief and long worry and praying the good Lord to look after the lad, for he never meant harm to anyone, that's clear.
Gavre spoke.
Times I think a man's lucky to work out his evils done here, where he did them, and so can go to dying without fear.
She looked curiously at him. What he said was not new to her. It was only a variant on the somber tenet of all her people, but there was in his voice a note of intense, suppressed emotion, echoing obscurely her own inward dark exultation. And the last word he spoke stayed with her. The builder of the prison house, the sneak thief, the weakener, the enemy, was fear. There was no way to serve fear and be free. During the next weeks, she saw Laurent daily, for most of each day, their companionship of the old years regained, and more than regained. It had used to be one-sided, Laura listening to Pierrot talking, Laura comforting Pierrot distressed. Now Pierrot could give and listen and comfort. It was a joy to her to be of use to Laura, and thus to receive, as it were, a sign or confirmation of her change from girl to woman, her wealth, which she could give away, spend as she chose. One afternoon, near the end of the month, they were together. They had been silent for half an hour. Outside, snow was falling again over the snow that whitened hills and fields. It was a hard winter, and this week was the cold heart of it. Guida was out in the cattle barns or the storehouses. Eleonora was lying down upstairs. She had not been very well. Laura and Pierrot sat sewing by the downstairs fire, looking now and then to the high south windows outside which the snow continued to fall thick and straight.
"I have to write a difficult letter,"
Pierrot said, a little while after the clock had struck three. Laura looked up, but did not ask to whom. To whom else could Pierrot consider writing?
"I want to ask him to come here for a little while, but you'll be back in Eisenar in a few weeks." "Well, I don't know. That's it, you see."
Laura rethreaded her needle, leaning forward to catch the tremulous, snow-thickened light of the windows.
"You want to talk to him about it?"
Pierrot nodded.
"May I say something I've been thinking?" "Indeed not." "You look like Auntie, you know, sometimes. I wonder if Auntie wasn't very pretty once. Papa says she was quite beautiful, but she never liked any of her suitors. Isn't it strange? Poor Auntie, she hates cold weather. She hasn't said anything but no all week. Does she need new yarn? I was thinking she might like this coral color. We can try. She hasn't even wound yarn this week. It's the rheumatism, or else she doesn't care anymore. Oh, Laura, I hope I die young sometimes."
"I know. Well, it was just this. You haven't talked about the wedding and so on, at all, really. I wondered if you were feeling a sense of duty, that you ought to stay here."
"No, that isn't it. Do you know, I don't think I believe in duty."
"It is an odd idea when you think of it," Laura said, thinking of it.
"Like Miss Nina Bunin in Portacheca, living and living and living with that awful mother of hers who goes on dying and dying and dying. She's been dying ever since I was born, and poor old Lonce Abre, who was supposed to marry Nina, he must be 60 now, and still running errands for Advocate Kesenai. Oh, no, not that kind of duty. That is just cowardice."
"Yes, very well. But Count Orlant isn't awful."
"No, no, he's not. He is a very, very good man,"
Pierrot said soberly.
"Is that it?"
"No, because Givon Costa is a good man, too. I do love him."
"I know you do.
Then what is it, Perry? It isn't us. It isn't me you're thinking of. You're not that foolish." "No, I'm not that generous. I'm not that useful to you. I'm selfish, Laura.
I'm thinking only of myself, but I'm not clever enough to settle my own fate.
Then let Mr. Costa do it for you.
I can't,
Piera said. Then, after a rather long pause,
I find I can't, Laura. I don't know why. In Eisenar I could. It's all so simple down there, ready-made. But up here I seem to change, to have changed. I'm not the person who is to be married in Eisenar in March, and that can't be. If I'm to marry, I must marry with all my heart. Anything less would be wrong. A lie. An unforgivable lie.
I believe that. But we may be wrong, Perry. Does love matter as much in marriage as the will to love? I don't know. I keep watching people, trying to find out. Is it simply that you're away from him that makes you feel you've changed?
No. It's that whenever I am with him, or whenever I think of him, I'm indoors, inside, in the light. And how can I turn my back on all the rest?
The rest?
The darkness,
Piera said, looking up from her work.
Air, space, the wind, the night. I don't know how to say it, Laura. The things you can't trust, the things that are too big for you, that don't care about you. I am just learning what that is and what I am, and I can't leave it, give it up, not yet.
Then you should ask him to wait, Laura said slowly. I don't know if I understand you, but I think you have that right.
So that night, Piera sat down to write the most difficult of all her difficult letters. Her spelling had improved at the Ursulines, but she still hated to write things down. On paper, they became remote and trivial, humiliating. Valtorsa, Val Malafrena, 24 January 1828. Dear Jivan, we are all well here, and I hope you and Miss Costa and Batiste are well. It is still snowing and is the heaviest winter since 1809, the year I was born, Papa says. All the bays of the lake shore are frozen, and on some of them the ice will bear for skating, which is very unusual, but it does not last for long. This is difficult to write, and I hope you will understand if I ask if there is any possibility that, if the roads clear, you might come here to Valtorsa for a short visit sometime in the next few weeks before I planned to come down to Eisenar. Are you very busy at the customs? If so, I shall certainly understand. It is hard to write, and I hoped to talk to you if possible, but if not, do not worry. I will come as planned. My father is not quite well yet from the laryngitis in December, and it is partly that which I want to talk about with you, but I hope we can talk because it is so hard to write. But do not worry if you cannot come. I will come. My love to Batiste. I am, as ever, your very affectionate friend, Piera Jivana Valtorskar. The letter went down on the Eisenar post on Monday, and back with the Montaigne diligence the following week came Costa's reply. I shall arrive on February 8th.
Oh, Lord, Piera said to herself. Now I've made him come in the dead of winter and wait to change coaches at Eremme and leave his work.
Costa was head of the Secretariat of Customs Inspection and Regulation for the Western Marches.
And I've got to tell Papa what I've done. Papa, she said that night after supper, you know I wrote Mr. Costa last week.
You always do, my dear,
Count Orlant said reassuringly. He was comparing astral maps, trying to decide how many Pleiades there were. Note. There are over 1,000 stars in the Pleiades star cluster, up to 14 of which can be seen with the naked eye. Traditional names for the cluster disagree on whether there are seven sisters, as in the Greek myth, or six, as in Japan and India. End note. She came to the table and looked over his shoulder for a while.
Is that one a Pleiade?
A Pleiad, my dear. One Pleiad. Several Pleiades. It's Greek. No, it's a neighbor. Do you see, this map shows seven. It agrees with our peasants, who call the group the Seven Sisters. But most people can see only six, and the book says at least 12 can easily be seen with lenses. but this map shows 8. It's very odd. I wonder if they eclipse from time to time.
I wanted to tell you about the letter.
Letter? Oh, yes.
Count Orlant sat back in his chair and rubbed the bridge of his nose.
I asked him to come here.
To come here?
Said her father, looking scared and also a little affronted.
I'm sorry I didn't ask you first, Papa. I felt so stupid about it, in case he couldn't come anyway.
What is wrong, Piera?
I need to talk to him.
But you'll see him next month in Eisnar.
The Count was really shocked, and Piera's heart sank.
I want to talk with him and with you about putting off the wedding for a while.
I see.
I didn't want to tell you before he answered my letter, in case he couldn't come, because I didn't want to worry you, and I'm not really sure about anything, but he says he will come on February 8th, so I wanted you to know.
She ended feebly.
He'll stay here, of course,
Count Orlant said, also feebly.
I expect so.
Yes, where else?
Count Orlant had met Costa only briefly and was afraid of him.
But is it... Are you regretting your engagement?
No, but I want to wait.
It was the only formula she had, and the only explanation Count Orlant, and later Eleonora, could get out of her. She shook her head, knitted her broad, stubborn forehead, and said,
I have to wait.
Then she would say imploringly,
Don't you think he'll understand?
Count Orlant thought he would, but Eleonora said,
I think he'll agree, dear, since he is a gentleman, but I'm not at all sure he'll understand.
Givon Costa arrived in Portaceca towards the end of the winter day. Piera and old Godin met him with the open buckboard, since the heavy horses that pulled the family carriage were not sharp-shod and the road was icy. He was half-frozen from the coach journey and almost completely frozen by the time they had driven down through the foothills in the still, bronze-colored, bitter, cold mountain twilight to Valtorsa. He was so humanly grateful that even Count Orlant was unable to be afraid of him and took pleasure in reviving him with food, drink, fires, and early bed. And Piera, alert and silent, watched him. She had known him always in one setting, Eisnar, his house or the Belenin house, afternoon or evening, among people he knew, dressed as he was dressed, speaking as he spoke. Now she had seen him out of place, on the snowy street of Portaceca, wearing a fur-lined Russian overcoat, looking cold and tired and anxious, and this man, this stranger, attracted her powerfully. Next morning, she came downstairs in her old red skirt and peasant blouse, and the cook scolded her.
Contessina, what sort of a way to dress is that when there's a gentleman in the house?
There's always a gentleman in the house while my father's here, and I dress to please him, said Piera.
And then, because the old woman was huffed, she made up to her again, hugging her and whispering,
Oh, Maria, Maria, don't scold me today.
The sun had come out brilliant on the snow. They spent a pleasant day, Count Orlant, Piera, and their visitor, walking down the shore to the Sordes, receiving a visit from Cousin Betta and the Sorrenti girls, and riding to St. Anthony's. On the second morning, Piera and Costa walked down to the lake shore alone in the bright wind of the thaw, and there came to the point. He spoke rather brusquely,
Piera, I hope that you know I want no explanation. I was very glad to come. It has troubled me sometimes that I had never been here, to meet your people.
It was partly that. I wanted you to see me here, too, and I wanted to see you here.
You're no different here or anywhere. Not to me, Piera.
His gentleness made her flinch.
I am different here,
she said, hearing the cold, stubborn sound of her voice.
You love this place and these people very deeply. I knew that, but you were right to bring me here.
He stopped, and stopped walking, standing to look out over the flashing, windy water to the hunter, dark under its crown of snow. She said nothing, and presently he went on. And forgive me, once again, you're very young, 18 years old, and are your father's only daughter and only child. There is time. There is no cause, no reason to rush you. If you wish the engagement between us to end, if you wish to be released, you need only tell me.
She stood beside him, pulling her shawl up round her neck as the cold, bright wind rose, rattling the trees. This was, of course, the one thing she had not expected. She never did expect the right thing. This was so easy, too easy, this cutting of the Gordian knot. You can't go about cutting knots or things begin to fall apart. He was being kind, ultimately, sacrificially kind to her, as he was bound as a gentleman to be. But it was not kindness she wanted.
I didn't mean to ask you that, Jivan. I only want, I think, to wait. For a while. If we'd married right away, last spring, it would have been all right. But I feel I must wait now. But I don't want to make you unhappy.
It would make me very unhappy to know that I had in any way lessened your happiness. Piera, don't perjure your heart in trying to be merciful to me. He was a gallant man. She turned to him as if in anger, her eyes alight.
But that's what you're doing, not I. I don't know what I want, and you do.
I can't ask of you what you cannot freely grant, he answered, stiff.
There's no chance of our ever living here?
She asked at last, childishly, very softly, knowing the answer.
No, he said, and unable to say more, he walked away from her along the shore. She watched his spare, slight figure against the wintry brightness of the lake, on the empty shore between water and sky. He came back and stood near her.
Isn't it best, he said quietly enough, to break all bonds, Piera, and let time work as it will? I had intended to ask you to wait until you're 20. Perhaps you had that in mind. But it is scarcely fair to you, and it could be much harder in the end if there were promises left between us. You know in any case that I won't change. But that's not a promise, only a fact. I can't help it.
He smiled and turned away, unable to look at her, waiting for her answer.
But can't we... But what will you...
She clenched her hands in a kind of rage.
All right, Jivan, let it be so. I wish you'd chosen better, chosen a woman who knew her own mind.
I never saw you till now, he said, turning back to her. I never knew you.
He spoke the truth. He was afire, his restraint broken, so that they stood face to face for once. Piera raised her hands open towards him, her eyes on his. He looked down.
I'll leave tomorrow on the post, he said in a contained, dry voice. They started back to the house together in silence. He took her arm to help her over a patch of thawing mud on the path. She looked down at his strong, thin hand on her sleeve. He said nothing and did not look at her. That night she had to tell her father that the engagement was broken, not extended, and that she had broken it. But inwardly she protested her words. It was he, not she, that had refused. He knew now that what he asked of her she would give, and would not ask, denying his own passion, denying her the right to passion.